Good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray. News time is 8:15. We have Summit County Council Chairperson Chris Robinson on the phone to give us an update on the council meeting yesterday. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome, Carolyn.
So, Chris, let's start off. You're going to have to talk fast, by the way. So I am hoping to get some kind of input from Summit County on just this whole UDOT noise abatement project. There's a, you know, of course, we recognize the interstates are not part of county jurisdiction, but there's a group called Citizens Against the Wall, and they are arguing that UDOT is not in compliance with their own guidelines for building this noise abatement wall, which may be voted in by some 23-24 property owners. They say the noise levels and the cost projections that UDOT has put together are not correct, and UDOT says they are. And I'm just wondering, what is the county's role? I think a lot of our listeners wonder what the county's role is at this point. And we're looking at a 3,200-foot long, oh gosh, anything 18-foot high berm wall combination to abate the noise coming off of the highway. What happens next? Where do we go with this standoff?
Well, the county is somewhat on the sidelines. We have met with UDOT numerous times. I think we're generally opposed to it, although there's a small part of us that is, we don't have to live in those 23 houses. And so it's not like we don't care about those people's feelings and opinions. But in the general picture, we wish there weren't under consideration a wall. It was triggered by a study. Whenever there's a highway improvement undertaken, which such as the climbing lanes going westbound, under federal rules, you have to trigger a noise study. And in this case, it only raised the noise 1 decibel, but there was already excessive noise. And so that set in motion this process that no one at UDOT or at the county can stop, provided they're following the rules. Now, lots of people have opinions about whether rules are being followed or not, and the test is really, you know, figuring that out. And I know that Citizens Against the Wall believe it isn't, and UDOT believes it isn't. I don't know where the truth lies on that. But I do think even if the 23 people vote to approve it, or a majority of those do, whatever the required percentage, that there'll be an opportunity to sit down with them and consider other alternatives. And that's an instance where the county would have a chance to intervene. But as to stopping it, we don't have any ability. We don't have a veto, nor does UDOT, provided they're following the federal rules. And again, that appears to be a matter of debate as to whether they are or not.
So next steps for the county, just sit back and see what happens with the ballot, which is going out sometime in the next week or two.
Yeah, and then after that, there'll be a chance to meet with the affected parties and see if there isn't a better way to do this that's less intrusive and it gets the most of what they want. But so
okay, well
that's the basics.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Let's move on to talk about tax increases. We're looking at both possible property tax increases as well as a tax rate increase. Can you kind of give us a rundown on where things stand with that? Will there be truth and taxation hearings coming up soon? What's the status of all this?
The manager is proposing an increase in two tax rates. One, the municipal tax, and one, the general fund, that's the general fund tax, both of 27%. It would bring in a total of $4.1 million. The general tax increase would affect everybody in the county. The municipal one would affect only those living outside of incorporated cities and towns. And the budget committee has served up a budget that is based on a 15%, not a 27% increase. The 15% increase generates $2.6 million and would be an amount that would allow for us to continue to provide the services we are, but would not add anything to fund balance. And some of our fund balances are drawn down. the extra difference between the 27% and the 15% would allow us to increase fund balances. We will have two additional hearings in December. I forget the dates. I want to say it's something on the order of the 6th and the 13th, if those are Wednesdays, one in the Basin, one in Colville. And, of course, this will be for the 2018 tax property taxes. And there will also be a notice that will go out sometime soon with your tax bill that will state or describe the tax increases. And there will also be, well, I should also say that on a primary residence for $100,000 of value, the municipal tax is some $19, and the general tax is some $34 per $100,000 primary for $100,000 of value. And so that's kind of the broad stroke summary.
Okay. And so at this point, do you support the property tax increase as well as the municipal tax increase?
If you're asking if I personally support them, I believe we will vote to increase the taxes to some degree. We have not decided collectively, nor have I individually, whether that's going to be at 15% or 27%. But I think it's highly likely that after these hearings that we will have some kind of a tax increase.
Okay, so there were department presentations that were made last night at the meeting, and then we've got a couple new things happening in the county, the sustainability department, and I believe we have a wellness strategic planning projection or plan that has been introduced. And how are these impacted, if at all, by this tax increase? If it doesn't come through, if we don't go to 27%, do these departments, you know, basically defund, or what happens there?
Well, we do strategic planning periodically, and sustainability, environmental conservation, mental wellness, and substance abuse are all important initiatives to us. And so at the 15% level, like I said, all of those initiatives would be funded. What wouldn't be funded is any increase to fund balance. And we have spent down fund balances, which is historically how the county has operated on capital projects. It's been able to, with new growth, it's been able to avoid increasing taxes, and it's been able to squirrel away money in fund balance and then build facilities. Currently, we're building in Camas a new library that's also a senior center and a satellite office to our health department. Spent $3.6 million on that out of fund balance. Because we're not getting the new growth, the reason to go to the 27% is to allow us to put roughly $1.6 million back into fund balance and start rebuilding those balances. So those initiatives that you mentioned are things we want to continue doing, and that's why I think it's likely that we're going to see a tax increase. Probably likely, at least at the 15% level. But as I say, that doesn't do anything to rebuild our fund balances, which are important.
Right. Okay. So let's move on to the Canyons Amended Master Plan. There's apparently a new way of measuring height, and instead of from ground, it's done from sea level. And can you give us a little bit of background on why we had to move to that kind of measurement and what it will mean ultimately for people living in that area?
Well, in the original development agreement, it would say that such and such parcel, RC16, let's say, is entitled to 5 stories. That's how high it could be. And then that gets into the definition of, well, what is a story and what does it actually, you know, add up to? And so you could say, well, the ground floor is 14 feet for commercial. Then each of the 4 stories above that is 11 feet because those are residential. And then you have a pitched roof on top of the 5th floor, and that needs to be 16 feet. And those are basically the numbers that were discussed. But what they're proposing to do is to go through that math on all the remaining parcels in the canyons, and they've compared what the maximum height would be above sea level had you computed yay many stories plus the ground floor commercial level plus the pitched roof. And they've said, okay, this is how high these buildings would have been above sea level. And now they're proposing some slight changes to that in this amendment. So the amendment does two things. It changes the method of measuring, and it says this building on this parcel will not be above 6,970 feet above sea level, full stop. And then it says, well, and then what it's doing is it's assigning new maximum heights to all these parcels based above a sea level measurement, which a surveyor can then go out and say, okay, this building is X feet. And the other thing that's good about it, I think, is that the already built buildings, we know their elevation above sea level as well. And so one can get a perspective of, is this building going to be higher or lower than my building? And so that's the story on the height.
Okay, more practical way of measurement. So in the Lower Village, it looks like a parking area is planned for about 1,100, 1,200 spaces, and then employee housing, 1,107 pillows. So what did the applicant's traffic study tell us about that project? And are we looking at, turn lanes and expanded roadways and changing out the roundabout? What does it all mean to the end user?
Well, I think it means that they're going to expand the types of things you just listed. And they also, one of the things that was brought up was that they need to agree on a formula for measuring the reduction in traffic, because there's some 20-something percent reduction that this is supposed to bring about, I don't know if it's in a reduction from current or from what the projected would be. I can't remember, but there will be a lot of things that should help to reduce traffic here. One is by having 1,107 employees live in the Lower Village. That means they're not having to drive to work, which, you just think about that. It's a big change itself. And then some of the things that are allied with the amendment, such as this proposed voluntary assessment area that would help fund remote parking. So that further provides a location for employees to park outside and take transit, and then improve a transit center in canyons. And so there's a lot of elements here that should be helpful. The amount of parking that they're building is really what's already there. They're just going to improve it. And we're working to make it so that parking is paid parking as a disincentive for people. We want to do two things: provide a disincentive to park there and an incentive to park elsewhere.
And is Vail on board with that?
Not yet.
Okay. I presume that means that it's being worked on.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, great. All right, we're going to have to leave it there, Chris. Thank you so much for being in touch. And this is Chris Robinson, Summit County Chairperson. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW Local News Hour. Time is 8:29. Good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray. Up now we have Adam Strawn, who is the chairperson of the Park City Planning Commission. He's here with another update on the Treasure Hill project. Thanks for coming by, Adam.
Thank you.
So let's dive in here. Treasure Hill. Senior planner Francisco Astorga, last night, I guess, went over 28 exhibits on the first page of the master plan for the Treasure Hill development. My understanding, it was an attempt to ensure that everybody was on the same page in terms of applying applicable standards. And I was hoping that you could just talk about these in general terms. And what does that mean? And where do we sit? Where are we standing on that?
Sure. So Francisco Astorga was asked by the commissioners to compare what the applicants have deemed revision 17.2, which is a revision to their original plan, reducing some of the density and size of the project. Francisco was asked to compare that revision 17.2 to the original Woodruff drawings from the original 1985 MPD approval. The Woodruff drawings are named after the architect who drew them. The analysis and comparison of revision 17.2 to the Woodruff drawings was one of the best analyses by a planner that I've ever seen. He gave heights, he gave flooring, he gave differentiations in the size and scale. He gave more information in those 28 sheets and in his presentation than we've had in quite a while. So I think all the commissioners were impressed, and I think all the commissioners were impressed not just as far as the quality, but impressed by the differences between the MPD and what we saw with revision 17.2.
Okay, so there are two major inconsistencies, excavation and the site plan?
Well, there are inconsistencies. The degree to which those inconsistencies exist is still, I think, a matter of debate. The applicant intends to respond to Mr. Astorga's analysis, so we will wait and see what they say about that.
Okay. So, Adam, it looks like there are also missing items that the Planning Commission is waiting for from the Sweeney brothers. But their attorney says that they're waiting for some kind of a fact sheet that they requested back in August. So can you talk about that dispute? Mark Harrington said that it's inaccurate, City Attorney Mark Harrington.
Sure. Let me just back up a little bit. So the fact sheet came out after the October 11th meeting, and the fact sheet is one of the appendices to the original MPD approval, which the city and our planning commission did not have prior to the October 11th meeting. That fact sheet came about because the applicant served a grammar request on the city, Government Records Access Management Act or something like that. But that popped out, and the grammar request is still pending. And their attorney got up and alleged that the city had been less than diligent in its response to that grammar request. And the attorney is Jeff Mangum, and I take it he's from the sort of litigation arm of their 7 or 8 member team. And you know, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When you're a litigator, everything looks like a piece of litigation. And I think that's a dispute that the lawyers and Mr. Harrington can work out, but it doesn't detract us from doing our job of applying the LMC to this conditional use permit application.
Okay. So Commissioner Laura Susser says the Planning Commission hasn't seen the claimed amendment to the MPD. What is the applicant saying the amendment provides, for one thing, and is it a significant item that would define what is allowed and what isn't?
Yeah, Commissioner Susser she was referencing some of the allusions that the applicant has made to the fact that the appendices, one of which is the fact sheet I just described, have been amended over the years, and that as a result of those amendments, some of Mr. Astorga's interpretations may be incorrect. And to date, we haven't seen the applicant's counter to Mr. Astorga's interpretations. So I think Commissioner Susser was saying, you know, if you've got something different, show us, because we haven't seen it yet. And that's our job. We look at the applicant's position and assess it thoroughly, but we haven't been able to see that position yet. And so I agreed with Commissioner Susser, as I think the other commissioners did.
Okay, so has the applicant been specific about what they're referring to in any way, or is it just referring to some document that...
No, I don't think it's a particular document or a particular amendment that changes the applicant's analysis, although I don't know for sure. But I get the impression from Mr. Sweeney, who's sort of the point person of their team, that they are aware of several amendments to the documents that may have some bearing on things. So we will anticipate those hopefully soon.
Okay. And then Commissioner Susser also comments on sidewalks and versus truck pullouts. Can you explain what all that is about?
Sure. This came out of a meeting a few months ago where transportation was the issue. And Commissioner Susser, one of the things that was presented to us by the city engineer and transportation staff, Alfred Knotts, was that sidewalks may not be a great idea on Lowell and or Empire because the presence of pedestrians in the traffic lanes works as a quote-unquote traffic calming device. That raised some eyebrows, and Commissioner Susser outright disagreed with using pedestrians for that purpose. And so she thought that putting a sidewalk in on Lowell and or Empire was a good idea.
Okay, so there is, so that hasn't yet been done in terms of the applicants?
No, I think the applicant's still trying to work out whether they want to use that extra width for some of the truck traffic or whether they want to use that extra width for a sidewalk. I think the city's trying to figure that out, too.
Okay. So then Commissioner Steve Joyce says he's done some research on dirt swell and those kinds of measurements, and that he is challenging the applicant's calculations and suggesting they're not legitimate. Can you give us a bit of a rundown on that, please?
Sure. So the issue there is that they have to excavate roughly 800,000 cubic yards of soil and rock. And once you excavate that soil and rock, it loses its compaction and it swells. And you have to deposit that somewhere, and it's going to be much larger than the 800. Well, it's going to be larger. We don't know by what degree. Than the 800 cubic yards. So the question is what the swell factor is, and it goes into how much of the Creel Gulch hillside is going to be used for a depository of soil and rock excavated from the project. So if you take 800, as Commissioner Joyce pointed out, and I'll try to get close to his words, but if you times 800 cubic yards by 20% versus 80%, it's a big difference. So that's what he was talking about there.
And so how do we reconcile that?
Well, we're going to have to come to a conclusion on what the swell rate is. And, you know, we're going to have to take the evidence that we have in front of us and reach a reasonable conclusion as to what the number is. It may not be 20, it may not be 80, it may be somewhere in between, but based on the evidence that we have, we'll reach a decision on that.
And would it involve changing the location of where the dump would be, where it would get dumped? Or
I don't know necessarily about the location being changed, but the impacts associated with that may change and the mitigation efforts may have to change. The biggest issue is that the area where the soil and rock is being deposited is in the recreation open space land. So the applicant, I guess, intends to put these 800-plus cubic yards over trees, over open space, over recreational area, and there's considerable debate over whether that's allowed, and if so, how and why. So that's an issue that we're getting close to, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Okay. There's also, just along that line, wasn't there a change in the methods that they were going to use to remove that
mm-hmm.
material? And
yeah.
it was originally a conveyor belt, but that's been decided, no, that's not going to work. The applicants have come back saying we're going to truck it, which means building roads and also moving dirt to build roads. Where is that? At the point that they'd come back, there was not an engineering plan in place for that. What's happening with that now?
Well, we've asked the applicant to put that down in writing because we need to assess the specifics and the details of that plan. And so far, the applicant has provided just verbal oral testimony from the head or some officer or representative of Big D Construction who tells us that it's entirely possible and here's how he and his workers can do it. But oral testimony is not what we need. It's part of what we need, but we need a written plan with specifications, hours of day, number of trucks, width of roads, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And until we get that, it's kind of hard for us to do a thorough analysis.
So we're coming up on a recommendation time frame.
We are.
Very soon. Is that feasible that you'll have that in time to make the recommendation?
That's up to the applicant. If, you know, it's not provided, then our decision, you know, will be made accordingly. It's in the applicant's interest to provide that information. I mean, it's the applicant's burden to provide us with the information that warrants approval. And if we don't have that, the default is denial. So the ball's in the applicant's court there.
Okay. Now, employee housing. So can give us an idea of how much is required. Will it be on site?
We went into – I didn't expect to see that last night, and I'm not prepared on the exact numbers of the employee housing, and I apologize for that. Mr. Sweeney gave a rundown of the employee housing and what will be on site, and to my knowledge, there is not a dispute between staff and the applicant as to that employee housing and it being located on site and so forth. And then, of course, there's a fee in lieu element, which Mr. Sweeney touched on last night. I can't give you, however, the exact number of UEs that are allocated to affordable housing or the fee in lieu amount. Mr. Sweeney, I think, mentioned a number of $3.5 million or $3 million as a fee in lieu amount. So that's as specific as I can get.
Okay, and it looked like it was somewhere around a 7,000 square foot.
Yeah, it was like 6,999 or something. I don't have the specifics.
Not there this week on that one. That's fine. And then finally, there was some public input about phasing of the project. And can you talk about your response to that?
Well, phasing is one of those things that we need specifics on, just like the excavation plan from Big D. We need to know exactly what's being phased, when, and what the impacts are associated with that. So, the phasing plan that we've gotten is it needs some more specifics. It needs some details. And Arnie Rustin, who's been a diligent member of the public and attending the meetings and providing helpful public comment, pointed that out. And I think the commissioners agree with him insofar as he alluded that the applicant needs to provide more specifics about that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Adam, for coming by.
Thank you.
That's Planning Commissioner Adam Strawn. You've been listening to KPCW's Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray. Good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray. I have longtime resident author and publisher Katie Mullally in to talk about a class she's teaching through the Park City School District's Adult Learning Program. Welcome, Katie. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Carolyn.
So, Katie, you've authored the Land of series of children's books, and now you've started your own publishing company. Tell us a little bit about this and about your books and what made you decide to jump into the world of publishing.
Well, it was actually 4.5 years ago I took a self-publishing class through Stacy Demolsky, who has become the self-publishing mentor for many of us. and left that class realizing that self-publishing is possible and legitimate and terrifying still, but, and then decided that I had taken a class with another book in mind, but when I left that class, I decided, okay, let's get these children's books started. I'd had the ideas for the books for a few years and realized that it was possible. And so from there on, from there forward, I just started a business, started a publishing branch, learned all I could about, the publishing industry, children's books, the children's book industry, layout, writing, design, printing. And lo and behold, 3 years ago, my first book, no, 2 years ago, my first book came out, Land of Or. And at this point, we have the three we, meaning my illustrator and I. We have Land of Or, Land of and Land of I Am. I'm sure a lot of you have seen them at Dolly's or at Atticus. And each land is a different life lesson, and we're working on book four right now called Land of When. And in talking with Stacy last winter, she encouraged me to teach a class on how to self-publish a children's book because it's a huge learning curve. And I had to spend a lot of time just researching, scores and scores of websites and information and deciding what to keep, what to throw out, what to ignore in order to create what I've done. And I'm still learning about this industry and about this process. And so I wanted to turn this into a class for others to maybe get a step up on the process.
Okay, so is publishing a children's book a different animal than publishing, say, a novel or a nonfiction?
Yes, because there's a lot of other things to consider besides just the words and the editing. There's the interior, there's the illustrations, first of all. That's the first thing we all think about with children's books, are those beautiful drawings that, inhabit every book. And, I was so fortunate to have found my illustrator, Toby Allen, who's done a brilliant job and who is great to work with. So, again, first of all, there's the illustrations. And it's writing a story that fits with the illustrations or having illustrations fit with the story. There's also things like word count. When you're writing a typical novel, word count isn't as constrained. You look at most kids' books, say 5 to 8, 5 to 10, you've got 1,400 words to work with. That's not a lot. So you have to be very specific and very concise and very intentional with the words you choose. It's also how the story is broken up. It's, again, with a typical novel, you just read page to page to page, and the only real sections are the chapters. Well, with a children's book, each two pages, or spread as we call them in the industry, is in a sense a chapter of its own, because those few words on those pages need to go with the illustrations, and they have to be a complete, almost complete idea within each spread. So there is that to consider. And then there's also the issues of printing and distribution. Are you going to do a hardcover book like I did? Are you going to do a paperback? How are you going to sell them? How are you going to market them? And so it's a lot more to consider.
Right. And so have you ventured into any other kind of publishing efforts, or have you contracted with anyone else to help publish their books?
Well, actually, I have. I've expanded my company. So Faceted Press is my publishing company, and I publish my books. I've expanded to an imprint called Surrogate Press, where what I do with that is basically I birth your book and give it back to you. I charge a one-time flat fee for the layout and publishing, and then from there on out, it's all yours. So all the money that you make, you keep. You keep all the rights. Carly Stenmark just wrote a book called More Than a Manicure, and I published her book, and that was a lot of fun. So, and that business is really starting to pick up because a lot of people, they understand the complexities of the publishing world, and not that I understand them all, but I'm getting there, and they realize that they don't want to have to either A, go find a publisher that's going to take most of the profits, or B, learn all of the steps for self-publishing and then that continuing effort that you have to put out. So they just come to me, I publish a book, and I say, here you go, it's all yours.
So how does it compare to using a well-known publishing house?
So what happens with a typical publishing house is, there's pros and cons, and this is one of the things we're going to talk about in the class. With a traditional publishing house, yes, you get your books on all the shelves. You get all of the major distribution channels. They print the book for you, and that's a big deal, especially if you have a hardcover book like mine. However, they keep the rights. Which can also include, you know, movies, toys, any of the ancillary products that can come out. They have a lot of say, if not all say, in the illustrator and the editing and the story content. So that can be a good thing, because one of the biggest complaints with self-published books is the editing. And, you know, that's, again, something else I'll teach in this class is really find a good editor that you trust, someone that will challenge you and someone that won't just say, no, this book is great as it is. And then with these publishing houses, they keep, understandably, most of the money because they're doing most of the work. You get a small percentage. Usually it's, I think, around 10%. I might be wrong on that. And as a, you know, unknown small author, you still do most of your, if not all of your marketing. And that's still the hardest part, regardless of whether you're a published author or a self-published author. None of us went into this for the marketing. We went in to write, to create our stories. So you still do the marketing. And so, you know, aside from, yes, you've the distribution and the printing covered, you know, it's, I don't feel like you get the support and money that you could had you gone on your own route.
Yeah, you know, it seems that even a well-known author is still pushing their book. They're mm-hmm. still doing a book tour. They're, you know, on
right.
shows and at signings and that kind of thing.
Mm. Well, and here's the great thing with, you know, Amazon, as much as we like to vilify it because it is a behemoth that we all need to deal with, it has a program called CreateSpace, where if you have a paperback book, this is a fantastic option because it's called, it's a print-on-demand service. So you load up the file. Of course, you know, you need to have them professionally, the interior is professionally designed and the covers, and so we do that as well. But once it's uploaded into the CreateSpace system, it's on Amazon. And so anyone around the world can order it. They print it as it's ordered and they ship it. So you don't have to worry about keeping thousands of books with you. But you can, but you also can order, let's say you want to order 20 books or 100 books. You order those at the print price. And so that's another great way to, you know, get your books out there. And you don't have to, again, have to deal with the publishing company taking all the control.
Yeah, so has the publishing business changed a lot in recent years since services like that are available and since
people are... You know, I've only really been in this industry for 4 years. And so just in the last 4 years, seeing the additional offerings and services that these print-on-demand companies provide, these extra services for distribution, what I'm seeing a lot of, which I think is great, is there's more of a legitimacy in the self-published or independent published world. Before, it used to be called, you know, a vanity press. Well, no one would publish your book, so you did it yourself, which was the assumption. But now, a lot of us aren't even considering going to a traditional publisher. That didn't even cross my mind. I didn't want to lose, like I said, the control, the rights, the vision. And so again, I think the biggest change in the last few years is just the legitimacy. You know, when some of the bigger distribution companies are understanding that there are a lot of good books out there and they're providing ways to distribute them.
So it also seems that you might have to have quite a lot of confidence in your project to venture in this way,
yes.
sort of forging ahead, saying, I believe in this and I'm going to
yes.
make it happen.
It's true. And that confidence wanes a lot. Sometimes you think, oh my gosh, I'm a total fraud. Someone's going to find out about me any second now. But you really go out there. It's a belief in your book. And that's one of the things, again, talking about the class, is talking about why are you doing this? And that's an important thing for anyone who's undertaking any creative endeavor to consider. You know, what is your why? Are you trying to make money? Well, that's if you're doing it for the money, that's not going to happen, or it takes years. Are you doing it because you believe in it? Great. Are you doing it because you have a passion for it? Great. So it's really go before you take any another step towards this industry, you have to understand why you're going to do it and if you are in it for the long haul, because it's a long haul.
So that sounds like a great adult picture book. What is the why?
Mm-hmm. That's
maybe that's your next series.
We have the why in the Land of Ore and the Canyon of Why, where it talks about in choices, so it can expand upon that and have a whole Land of Why.
Mm-hmm. I like that. So tell us about the class, please.
So what I'll be doing is it's two nights through the Park City School District, the Compass. It's going to be on November 6th and 13th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. I think it's at the high school. What we're going to do, and one thing to note, this is not a class on how to write. I've had students show up before in classes that I've taught that wanted to really talk about the manuscript itself. And this is not a class on writing. What it is it talks, this class, you'll learn things about book layout. Again, the spreads that I talked about. How to work with an illustrator. I have a section that my illustrator, Toby Allen, wrote, which is great because it's from an illustrator's perspective on what they need and how they like to work with people. We'll talk about printing options, publishing your book, marketing, distribution, and other materials that you need. I mean, a lot of you have probably seen me at the Silly Market on Sundays. There's a lot of equipment that goes into selling these books. It's not just the books. It's the tents and the banners and the tables and the signs. And really, this is just I don't want to ever dissuade anyone from being a self-published children's book author. However, I want them to understand what it really takes. And so this class, I feel like, is a really good introduction. And what's great is I've got two students from a class that I taught last winter whose books are almost ready to come out. They're both self-publishing, so they're going to be ready by Christmas. So
can you reveal what that is?
I can't because I can't remember what the books are. They live in Salt Lake.
Okay.
But I just got a note today from one of them. But really, this is just kind of the do's and don'ts. And, are you ready for this? Can you do this? Are you willing to commit?
Okay. So one final on-the-spot question. What's your favorite children's book other than your own?
Ooh, that's a good one. I mean, of course, it's Dr. Seuss. Everything's Seussian is just my favorite. But, I'd have to say Dr. Seuss. There's too many to choose from. But if it's Seussian in nature, then I love it.
Okay. Good enough. Thank you, Katie Mullally, for coming in. And this is Katie Mullally. She's author and publisher. She's teaching a publishing class through the Compass, and appreciate you coming by.
Thanks, Carolyn.